I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Perhaps the best example of what's called biomimicry comes from the Wright brothers. When they were planning their early prototypes of flying machines, they studied birds, in particular the soaring and gliding skills of the vulture. Now, while there have always been people who rely on a walk in the forest to better understand how things work or how things ought to work, biomimicry is a relatively new science. Much of our recent history, from the Age of Enlightenment through the Industrial Age, has seen humans bent on the destruction or the domination of nature. Today, as part of our Innovation That Matters series, we look at how the latest tools of science are leading us back to a better understanding of many things that nature's already figured out. We'll be talking with the scientist and writer Janine Benyus. We'd also like to hear from you as we continue our look at the relationship between technology and this world. We ask again, now that we can do anything, what will we do? Do we have more to learn from innovations in nature than from our limited human imagination? Should we be fixing our scientific sights on the silk of the spider, the hollow hairs of the polar bear, or the maneuvering skills of the dragonfly? Have we wandered too far from nature's rhythms and processes to shift gears now? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Janine Benyus joining us now from a studio in Missoula, Montana. She's a biologist at the Design Table and founder of the Biomimicry Guild. Janine, it's nice to have you with us on the program.
It's great to be here, Dick.
Can I ask you to start with an example of where people today are borrowing from nature to make something new and better? You direct us in your book, Biomimicry, to the surface of the lotus leaf. Where are you taking us with that?
Well, the lotus leaf is a great example because it's something that leaves are all around us, but we haven't looked at them closely enough. And some scientists in Germany took a look at a lotus leaf, and they were fascinated by it because even though the lotus grows in the marsh and it's, you know, comes up through this muck, it always looks dry and pristine and clean. And so they thought, how is it keeping itself clean? And when they looked up close, they saw that it had bumps, very small nano bumps on it. And what's actually happening is that dirt, instead of adhering strongly to a smooth surface, is actually teetering on those bumps. So dirt particles teeter, and then when rainwater hits the leaf, it balls up. And it's waxy. It's also a waxy surface. And as it rolls off, it picks up those loose dirt particles, sort of like a snowball picking leaves up off your lawn. And so the lotus leaf uses the free motion energy in rainwater to keep itself clean. And so now people are saying, okay, they've taken that, what's called the lotus effect, and they've put it into all kinds of products, building facade paint, and when it dries, it has these bumps, and rainwater cleans the building, for instance.
Now, there's also a part in the book where the glue that a mussel uses to stick its foot underwater is also connected to paint. Am I right?
Well, yes, it's in that when we put paint on, we have to prime because in order to get paint to stick and to not be vulnerable to water, to bubbling up, you have to prime it. And what's interesting about something like a mussel that glues itself to the bottom of your boat or to a pier, it's gluing underwater. So water being the bad boy of adhering,
yeah.
It has no problem doing that. It cures, the glue cures in water, and that's something that we can't do.
Now, your own background is in forestry, in applied science. I'm wondering whether or not it was, in fact, a walk in the woods that got you thinking about, you know, what can be borrowed from what nature's already figured out.
Well, it was a very long walk in the woods pretty much my whole life. But, yeah, I was a nature nerd growing up, definitely, and spent a lot of time outside and a lot of time in awe and fascinated. And then I began to write nature books to sort of help other people fall in love in the way that I had fallen in love. And just in reading about so many incredible adaptations, you know, how a gecko is able to walk up a wall without glue, all kinds of adaptations day after day. And I thought, is anybody trying to emulate something as simple as how a leaf harnesses solar energy? And once I asked that question, I found a lot of scientists, biomimics, who are practicing, you know, this art of learning from nature in order to create new inventions, as their way of doing innovation.
But I get the impression it's still a relatively new discipline within science. Is that right?
Well, it's, you know, there have always been people who have looked to the natural world for inspiration. You have the, you know, Leonardo da Vinci and Bucky Fuller. I think what's different now is that there's a large group of people doing it. It's not just some individuals. We have the ability now to really be able to take a closer look at how nature does what she does. Not that we understand it all fully, of course, but just the instruments that we have, for instance, the ability, you know, to look at that lotus leaf up close and actually see the kind of bumps and how they're working, that's new. And so you have this capability now, and then you marry that with this real need we have to innovate in ways that will help us be around over the long haul here on Earth. So you have the pull coming from all these great sort of ability of you know, the new instrumentation, and then you have this push coming from our need to do things more sustainably. And I think that's why you see more biomimics.
I wonder, though, whether or not you're at all worried that science is at something of a crossroads here, because the very same tools that you know bring you closer to understanding the surface of a lotus leaf and the understanding, well, the microscopes and the nanotechnology that gets you a little bit closer to what we can learn from the natural world. These are the same tools that other scientists are using to imagine themselves as creating nature, cloning animals, genetically modifying seeds and plants so they'll do exactly what humans want them to do instead of what the plants themselves want to do. Are you feeling a little bit like there's a fork in the road ahead?
You know, there's always, Bill McKibben talks about, you know, our tools, our technologies are not, you know, inherently good or bad. It's really, you know, the kind of ideology that you bring into it as you're using them. And I feel the same way. Biomimicry is a fork in the road taken, and it's a fork taken, I think, by people who have a certain humility about them. I mean, they actually believe, the notion is that life's been on Earth for 3.8 billion years, mm-hmm. and that life's learned something about how to be here. And so there's a certain inherent humility. And I would hope that with that humility, I think biomimics realize there's so much to learn about and from the natural world, that this idea of, you know, being even better than nature is not the first thing that comes to their minds. They would like to be as elegant as the organisms they see in the natural world. You know, there's enough work to be done just to emulate them, much less to, you know, recreate them.
I can imagine.
But you're right. You're absolutely right. The same tools could be used.
I mean, if we look at agriculture, which is something that you focus on in biomimicry, the idea that the prairie, you know, sort of creates its own biosphere, which if you respect it, it takes care of its own pests and it takes care of its own cycles. You've got an agriculture industry that has moved, I was going to use the word past that, or moved in some way beyond that. And I'm wondering, as I imagine, you know, kind of a return to that mixed growth, whether or not it's practical, whether or not you have to look at that and sort of, well, it'd be nice, but we don't do that anymore. We genetically modify our seeds and we plant, you know, 10,000 acres of the same thing, and we've got combines big enough to haul all that in when we need to.
Right, right. Well, it depends on, you know, what you mean by the word practical. I think what we're finding is this industrial agriculture winds up causing problems of its own. And when you do an analysis of it, it's really not very practical in that, for instance, you mentioned, you know, that you plant the same sort of plant for miles. Mm-hmm. Well, that's sort of an invitation to pests. It's an all-you-can-eat restaurant. So if one pest gets going and finds the key to a particular plant lock, it has miles and miles, and that's how pest epidemics get going. So that's not real practical. And it's not really practical to dig up the soil each year and then have that soil bleed away into the Mississippi River. And it's not really practical to have such pest epidemics that you're putting in lots and lots of pesticides, which is an oil product, and then lots of herbicides, which is a natural gas product. And, you know, the diesel fuel. I mean, there have been calculations. David Pimentel says that we use 10 kilocalories of oil for every kilocalorie of corn. So that's this, you know, it seems efficient until you really start to look at those numbers. And then you say, that's not really, it's practical only if fossil fuels are cheap.
Janine Benyus is my guest this hour. She's a biologist at the Design Table, founder of Biomimicry Guild. And we're talking about what's practical and also there's some change of heart involved in what she's talking about when we're discussing biomimicry. We'd like to hear from you whether or not there's more to be learned from the natural world than we're willing to give it credit for. 1-800-423-8255. That's the number to join us this hour. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, in our ongoing series, Innovation That Matters, this hour, we're talking about something called biomimicry. Janine Benyus is our principal guest. She's a scientist and author of a book by that name, Biomimicry, Innovation Inspired by Nature. Our telephone number for you to join our conversations, 1-800-423-8255. We're also going to have with us for a couple of moments Julian Vincent. He's a biologist and professor at the University of Bath Center for Biomimetics and Natural Technologies, and he's joining us on the telephone. Julian, thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for asking me.
I understand that one of the things that you've been looking at is the lowly pine cone here. Can you tell me what the biomimicry lessons from the pine cone are that you've been examining?
Okay, so we had a contract to introduce ideas from biology into high-tech clothing. This is for our Ministry of Defense. And a soldier has to wear clothes, I suppose, which are going to be adequate under all conditions, and they think of having about 7 layers, I think. And one of the problems there, of course, is that you get rather hot. And so we decided that it would be rather nice to have a textile which could change its permeability, so that if you did get hot and sweaty, then the textile would open up and allow better circulation of air. And we didn't want to have a mechanism which needed energy, because that would probably produce its own heat, make the problem more difficult, and also make the person more easily seen on an infrared telescope at night. And so we had a look around plants, and specifically dead bits of plants, which just responded to changes in humidity. And, of course, the pine cone is one of these. The sort of valves on the outside open and close as it goes wet and dry, so that the seeds can get distributed under the best conditions. We had a look to see how it was done, and basically took that technology and put it into a textile. It's a bit crude at the moment. I've just got a student starting with me now. Although we're an engineering department, we've now got somebody from the London College of Fashion working with us.
Now, this is not some coniferous textile that you're working with. It's a man-made fiber that you're...
Because we now need to build into it some of the mechanisms that you find in plants. I think we're going to start having a look at ferns and mosses now, because they've got some really neat mechanisms for changing shape as the humidity changes.
Julian, do you do this by actually taking some gene from the pine cone?
No. I mean, I heard what you were saying about with Janine just now, with the genetic side of things. And in a way, that's a very simplified way of looking at things. On the other hand, I find it incredibly arrogant that man feels that by fiddling around with the genetic system of an animal or plant, it can actually drive that complex organism to go down a particular path when we've got no idea what these genes do, really. My thrill with all this, and it is a thrill, is to take a mechanism from nature, put it into an entirely alien environment. So, I mean, you said a pine cone, what's that got to do with textiles? Mm. Right, you know, that's the good question. Because if we can make a mechanism which works in pine cones work in textiles as well, that means we've understood something. You know, so it's not just a matter of making and having an invention. It's a matter of improving your understanding.
Janine Benyus, join us here because the part of my understanding, and it's limited, so you may have to help me here, of what science is doing with the silk-producing qualities of the spider, though, is in fact exploiting the latest in genetic modification in order to try and get the spider silk to do something useful for people.
Well, you're right. I mean, that's one way to go on mimicking spider silk. If you actually want to make the silk exactly the way the spider makes it, one of the ways that people are doing it now, which I don't think of as biomimicry, what they're doing is they're taking the gene from the spider and they're implanting it into a goat and having the goat milk out the protein in its mammary and then spinning that into silk. And that's, you know, actually getting as close as you can to that kind of silk. Now, biomimicry, as I understand it, is learning the design lessons from the natural world and then applying them yourself, not asking the spider to do it for you or asking the goat to do it for you. That feels to me like domestication with a twist. You know, we're still asking this organism to do it for us. There are also there's also work being done on just understanding what it is about that recipe, that chemical recipe that's going on in its chemistry in water. It's amazing in this abdomen of this spider at room temperature. There's a couple of different kinds of proteins, and those proteins are then squeezed out from the abdomen, squeezed out through these tiny little spinnerets. There are six of these spinnerets. And in the process of being squeezed out, this liquid soup turns into a fiber, a water-resistant fiber that is five times stronger ounce for ounce than steel. It's really an amazing chemical process going on. And there are people who are studying that recipe and saying, can we emulate that chemistry in our own labs without using a cloned goat to do it for us? What can we learn about making springy, strong, tough fibers, use our own materials, our own labs, and mimic that recipe?
Julian, I suspect you are nodding your head here in agreement.
Well, nodding and shaking at the same time, actually, is a bit difficult. I agree with Janine, absolutely, except for one point, and that is that spider silk does some magic things, but you have to realize that it's optimized for the spider and not for us. And that includes such things as the spider itself recycling the thread, and as Janine says, doing it at room temperature. It may be that we'd like to use the thread at slightly higher temperatures than the spider wants to, in which case we then do need to start doing extra things to it. Now, it may be that we'd be as well off modifying a gene and putting it into the goat and getting it to produce super spider silk. On the other hand, if you look at the way Kevlar is made, which is the fiber produced by DuPont, it has some characteristics which are very much like the way spider silk is produced, in that you make long, thin crystals before it actually comes out of the spider, and Kevlar does more or less the same sort of thing. Now, could we take some of the tricks that spider silk uses, which are to do with the way the molecules are bonded together and the sort of shapes they are, not necessarily to do with the intimate chemistry, and introduce those into Kevlar? Now, if we could do that, then we would have all the mass production processes of Kevlar available to us, but we'd then have also the tricks that the spider uses. And I heard earlier on say some talk of can we do better than nature. There's no reason why not, because nature is adapted for conditions which nature is adapted for, as it were. We may want to use materials under slightly different conditions or under very different conditions.
I'm going to steal from Janine's book, Biomimicry, here just to describe how you make Kevlar: pouring petroleum-derived molecules into a pressurized vat of concentrated sulfuric acid, boiling it at several hundred degrees Fahrenheit in order to force it into a liquid crystal form, subjecting it then to high pressures to force the fibers into alignment as we draw them out. The energy input, and Janine made this point earlier in the program, is extreme, and the toxic byproducts are odious. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. As we take a look at what it is we can learn from nature, we'd like to hear from you. We're going to take our first call from Natick, Massachusetts. Brandon's on the line. Hi, Brandon.
Hello, thanks for taking the call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a comment that I might want to follow up with in a second. Looking at this discussion of when you were talking about agriculture with Dr. Bennis, I kind of see the paradigm or paradigms being in the neighborhood of considering nature as an R&D facility versus nature as a manufacturing facility. For instance, using the idea of how a gecko climbs a wall to design a robot that can do the same versus using bacteria to produce genetically engineered insulin for pharmaceuticals.
Are you saying that those two are contradictory?
No, actually, I can kind of see where they converge at, I don't know if you could call it a molecular or submolecular level. It's just the thought process is that nature is there to be exploited or to be learned from, which I think is a theme that you're touching on earlier in the discussion.
Janine, jump in here.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think, there's a lot of bios out there. So I get asked, how is biomimicry different than other kinds of biotechnology and whatnot, as I understand it. And I think what the caller is talking about, a very good point, is that the way our sort of default technology is always bio-assisted technologies, milk cow to get our milk. I mean, we will always use organisms to help us do what we do, okay? But that's bio-assisted technologies. Bio-utilization is yet another bio, and that's, you basically cut a tree down and you make wood floors. Well, that's not biomimicry. It's bio-utilization. And the differentiation with biomimicry, I think, is that you're not using the organism. You're not domesticating it in order to do something for you, necessarily, but you're basically borrowing an idea, a design, a strategy, a recipe from that organism. And that's quite different. And then you abstract a design principle, and then you apply it, as Julian was saying, into your own sort of application. Now, I think the easy things to do, well, not so easy, but the first level of biomimicry is mimicking form, learning something from the structure that helps you get a function. You mimic those bumps
right
on the lotus leaf, for instance, The next level, it's deeper, it's harder, but you try to mimic that low temperature chemistry in water. You try to mimic the manufacturing process itself, and then ultimately you would try to mimic the whole ecosystem sort of strategy, and that's that level of having your whole economy sort of mimic a living forest rather than a machine on that ecosystem level. So three levels of mimicry are the form, the process, and then the ecosystem level.
And Julian,
each one of them are more difficult than the next.
Julian, if I'm not mistaken, you have researchers who are looking at the jumping capabilities of the flea and the locust and wondering if those can be applied, not by, nicking genes and things like that, but just in a practical sense to the way that robots work.
Well, I mean, you mostly think of a robot as going on time, or just going on and on and on and on. But you forget that it's plugged into the mains. And if you look at the way an animal uses its energy, or a plant for that matter, it spends most of its time sleeping. I don't know if you've got a dog, but ours seems to just get up for meals and walks and the rest of the time, and that's about it. And a plant, for instance, the only time that it's really important in the year is when it flowers and sets seed. but that's a relatively short part of its life cycle. The rest of the time, it's gathering all the energy to be able to do it. So if you want to make a robot which is going to explore planets, you've got to work out some way of getting its energy economy right. You know, that's one of the crucial things. And for getting around, we're reckoning that jumping may be a very good way. It's a sort of halfway house between walking, which is difficult over a terrain that you know nothing about, and flying, which, although it gets you there, it covers the best distance per unit energy absorbed or used, you do need to have that energy there all the time. And so we thought of jumping as sort of the middle way. And it's actually looking quite good. I was having a chat to one of the guys this afternoon about it. And we've made a sort of three-legged thing, which looks as if it weighs about half a kilo, I think. It looks as if it'll be able to jump up to a couple of meters, I think. Yeah, it's really good. But coming back to what Janine was saying, if I may, last time I saw her, we had a discussion about a device for dehumidifying air.
Mm.
And that was sort of her second example, where you take not just the function, which in this instance is a nanomembrane to pull water out of air, but then also some sort of function to go along with it and the whole design.
And Janine, this is using a beetle or a bug of some sort?
Well, not using them, but using the idea.
Right, that's
yes,
what I meant.
to get vapor out of air. And the reason I actually... We went to Julian, knowing that he was such a bug guy, and had a great expertise for many, many years. And we came to him with this challenge. We said, okay, in hot humid environments, it takes a lot of energy to cool wet air. You know how uncomfortable you feel in damp air. Mm-hmm. So if you're in Atlanta, you're trying to cool, it's huge amounts of energy. But if you could dry that air out before it entered the building, if you could pull water out of that air, and that's called a desiccant. And the desiccants we currently have, believe it or not, they're kind of energy intensive to recharge them. You actually have to heat up. It's this desiccant wheel of these sorts of salts, and you have to recharge them by actually heating them up and squeezing the water out.
Again, a complete waste of energy.
Exactly. So we're not using beetles. What we said was, hey, there's a whole suite of insects who don't drink water at all. They live, desert cockroaches and pill bugs and silverfish. They literally take vapor out of air. Some of them at as low as 47% relative humidity, which is not saturated air, they're able to pull vapor out of air. So we say, can we, you know, mimic the mechanism? And then even better than that, we can pull it out and then somehow move the water away, wick the water away. And you can imagine collecting this water then as gray water for the building. So, Julian, go ahead, tell
okay,
what you can.
I can't talk about some of it.
No.
There's some information
yes.
which is published, and that is the pulling the water out of the air bit into the liquid phase. And you do that with the nanomembrane, and there are two or three papers published on that. The trick is, what do you do with the water when you've got it into the liquid phase? And we reckon we've got that one taped, almost literally. It's a membrane. And we did some sums, and if this stuff were to work at full efficiency, it would use 1/1000th of the energy that current dehumidifiers use. So even if it were working at 1% efficiency, we would still be 10 times better than current systems. And, you know, how many times do you get a technological advance that gives you that sort of a jump? It's worth chasing.
Quick last question for you, Julian, in terms of the seriousness of the science. If you were to go to a conference and talk about this, would there be biologists and physicists and engineers going, what?
The sad thing is that biology seems to have moved away from this area, and the number of biologists like Janine and myself who've got a sufficiently wide background to be able to move the ideas around is currently relatively small. They're all playing around with DNA and RNA. But the physicists and the engineers in particular are really wowed by this. And in fact, The Observer, a UK newspaper, did a survey over the weekend, and it worked out what the top 20 hot topics for 2005 were, and biomimicry was rated number 5.
Congratulations. Thanks for being with us, Julian.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Julian Vincent, biologist and professor at the University of Bath Center for Biomimetics and Natural Technologies. We continue with Janine Benyus when we come back after our break. We'd like to hear from you on this question of what it is we have to learn from nature rather than just taking the very best from nature through what other means. Are there more basic lessons that ought to be learned there? And does that involve a change in mind, a change in heart? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection as part of our Innovations That Matter series. We're asking this hour whether or not we have wandered too far away from those rhythms of nature to ever go back and work within them, or whether or not we have a whole lot more to learn from the innovations in nature that some of the latest technology is leading us towards. Janine Benyus is with us. She's a biologist at the design table and founder of Biomimicry Guild, joining us from a studio in Missoula, Montana. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going next to Andover, Massachusetts. Kelly's joining us. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. Well, I was almost in hysterics. I do think that we've gotten too arrogant, and I was in hysterics yesterday overhearing a story on NPR about a native people living on an island that was badly affected by the tsunami, and the authorities thought no one on this island could have survived. No way. So they show up, and they're getting shot up by bows and arrows. Well, lo and behold, many of the people did survive, and the story then went on to say that researchers were interested in how these people might have avoided, perhaps they listened to birds or watched animals, mm-hmm. things like that. And so they were coming in to now study the technology. I could have sworn my ears heard technology. And so now I have this vision of these researchers showing up with all this modern equipment, and they're going to totally miss the point. So I think that it was a nice reminder to me that if we just, we're so used to as people and as scientists, manipulating first and then observing. We ought to switch it around and do a whole lot more observing first.
Janine, were you paying attention to those stories of the Andaman and the Nicobar people apparently avoiding a tidal wave that other people weren't able to avoid?
Yes. And what I found really fascinating also is that, you know, the science press was buzzing 2 days after the tsunami, because no one was finding any dead animals. You would fly over. Yes, you'd fly over, and there would be, unfortunately, carcasses of humans.
Right.
But no, where and this was in wildlife refuges, which had hundreds of elephants and leopards. Where were the animals? It seems that not only these people were able to avoid, the people who are not Western industrial culture people, they were, the indigenous people were able to avoid and get to higher ground, and also the animals were. And I'm struck by this scene of, you know, how when the water was sucked out, what people said was that, you know, a lot of people were fascinated, curious, and ran down to the water. A lot of fish were jumping around in the mud, and so people started to go in to collect the fish. Mm-hmm. So at the same time that people are rushing down, animals are moving away.
But let me take Kelly's point one step further, though. Would you be among those people going to try and figure out what it is that the leopard or the what tool the elephant used to know that something bad was coming? Or is there a point that you can't cross, Janine? Is there something mystical about nature that you really can't ever try and figure out?
Mm. Oh, I do know that, you know, the more you learn about the natural world, the more you realize how little we really do understand. We are looking through a glass darkly. In that the complexity that is there, and just, I mean, imagine these organisms and systems, including ourselves, having evolved for so many billions and billions of years. I think there is plenty of mystery to go around. I don't think it diminishes at all the awe or wonder to go in and try to understand. Mm-hmm. I don't think it makes I think the true biologists who look amoeba through zebra at the depth and breadth of the natural world, they are less arrogant with each passing year.
1-800-423-8255, next to Newton, Massachusetts, and Marilyn's with us. Hi, Marilyn.
Hello, good morning. I'm really enjoying this very much. If my husband were alive, he would have really loved this program. He was a self-taught engineer who became a biomedical inventor way back in the 50s and 60s. And I was very interested to hear Janine's description of the three areas of form, process, and the eco-environment. I found that really fascinating, and I want to give you an example of something he did that was like in the form area. He was a very keen observer of nature and so loved nature. He used to break out in smiles and say, "Oh, Mother Nature is so wonderful, I couldn't have done it better myself." Well, one of the things he did was he was kind of known as a miracle man, and he was invited by some medical technology companies to Florida because they were looking for a hypodermic needle. This was in the late 60s that could be used for, at that time, they didn't have anything when people had had too many needles put into them and you just couldn't pierce find any place in their skin anymore to get through. He said he didn't know anything about it, and they said, we want you to come anyhow. And he said the night before the conference, he woke up around 3 in the morning and said, "Oh, my goodness, I'm 30 miles from the best hypodermic needles in the world." And he drove over to the then-new Serpentarium in Coral Gables and pounded at the door, got the man up, and he said the next few hours they went through hundreds of skeletons of snakeheads. And he found the perfect hypodermic needle, which is still used around the world.
This is the fang of the snake that will inject the poison.
He found the perfect fang.
When he went to the conference, what did the people say, Marilyn? Did they say thank you very much, or are you on your mind?
He obviously got a patent, and they were thrilled. I mean, I don't know if it happened at the conference.
Right.
But, you know, it was... eventually, I mean, it was designed and it was made, and he was very proud of it. He also designed the instrument that's used to go into the veins, very, very narrow veins, and into the heart to insert a dye, which up until that point, he designed that in the early 70s. It took him a couple of years to convince surgeons that they could use it, and it was based on the movements of a snake.
I was only borrowing from Janine's book earlier, Marilyn, when I talked about going for a walk in the woods, because Janine, you use that as in many ways a description of what Marilyn's husband was doing, just thinking.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, and what is his name, please, Marilyn?
His name was Yitzhak Bentov. They used to call him Ben. Ben Bentov.
Great. I've been trying to find his name for a long time. That's a great biomimicry story, the fang of the rattlesnake used in a hypodermic needle. It's basically what he did is what biomimics do, which is to say, here's a design challenge. And the key question that we so rarely ask is, what in the natural world has already faced the design challenge I have and solved it? So he said to himself, you know, snakes have to inject a venom, right, into their prey. And so they have to get past the skin quickly. That's what I want to do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And do it in a way that the prey doesn't even know it's coming.
That's right.
You know, so that the prey doesn't wiggle out of the way. Right. So you want something that is almost unnoticeable. So the rattlesnake is faced with the same design challenge as somebody trying not to hurt someone putting a needle in, right? And he realized that.
Right. And one of the principles that he taught me that I've used, I mean, a life principle, I remember his saying to me, he was always doing that. He was, just a natural early biomimic, though he didn't call himself that. He used to say to me when I would be trying to do something, I wasn't very mechanical, and he was just had a huge gift. And it wasn't a gift for in mechanics, I mean, but a gift for understanding the way his things worked. In fact, I will just inject quickly that growing up, that his fave, he said he wasn't much of a cat and dog fancier, but he loved insects and he was learning from insects. But one of the things that he always said to me was, when you're trying to do something, when you're working with something, never force. Watch the way it likes to go and then do it that way. I'll never forget that. I thought that was such an important thing to learn, and I think that that's kind of, it sounds to me like one of the fundamental principles of biomimicry.
It fits.
Absolutely. It's deep observation, yes.
And fits, I think, Janine, well within that list of sort of that checklist of here's how nature does it, here's what we have to learn about, you know, the limits, for example. I mean, when you talk about nature having a limit that it has to live within, I mean, I get how that works for us. I'm less clear about how it works for nature.
Well, you know, when you talk about something like creating... Say you're an abalone. You know, you're a snail, a large snail. That's what they are. They're giant marine snails in the ocean, and you need to. You're living in the tidal zone, in the rock and roll of the tidal zone, and you need to protect yourself from predators and from waves, and you have to create something hard, a shell around yourself.
Right.
Now. What we do is we've been doing this for 5,000 years. We take earth slurry, you know, to make a ceramic, like a shell is a ceramic. We take earth slurry and, you know, we heat it up. We put it in an oven, you know. Well, the abalone can't do that because if it was to heat itself up, it would die. So the limit that it has is it really can't use brute force, as your caller was talking about. It can't use brute force, you know, because it has to manufacture near its own body.
So
that's the limit. And then it also has to use what's available. So how does it get the minerals that it needs? And what it turns out to be is there, the seawater is full of the calcium and carbonate, but they're little ions. They're not yet formed into the shell. Somehow it has to beckon to those ions, get those minerals to land in a particular shape, in a particular structure to create this very, very strong ceramic without fossil fuels, without heating up. And at that limit has, you know, brought forth the most elegant ceramic manufacture, completely different mechanism than what we use, and we're now learning from that.
I just want to say thanks to Marilyn for her call, and let Marilyn and others know that if you want to find out more about biomimicry and Janine's work, you can go to our website. We are at theconnection.org. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us. Next, Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Charlie's on the line. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling. Tell me what you're thinking.
What I'm thinking is humans have been copying nature forever since the cavemen started putting on disguises to hunt for animals. And the current fascination seems to be with not mimicking but digitally copying, and that in the future we're going to come back to, or maybe even now we're coming back to biomimicry because it works and it always has worked.
The idea being implicit in that, Charlie, is that the idea that copying nature didn't really work very well.
Well, copying nature has some great points. It is working in certain ways, but biomimicry is not going to go away, and it works just as well, or in a lot of cases better.
I think he's right that we have. I think it's a very old. People say it's new. I think it's really. Old. I think we always looked at organisms that we admired. And for instance, the Inuit still hunt in the exact same way as the polar bears. They watch the polar bears creep up on their bellies to a hole to get the Weddell seal. And that's what the Inuits do to this day. They even cover their noses the way a polar bear will cover its black nose so that it's completely white. We used to do this. I think there was a time in which we truly admired the organisms around us. And so it was natural for us to mimic. And then we got away from it when, you know, we got into this whole sort of petrochemical genetic engineering revolution, we could synthesize anything we wanted, you know, and we got away from that. And now I think we're circling back around.
And there's a bigger part of the science as well, Janine, and that is not just necessarily how an abalone makes its shell or what makes a mollusk stick to the rock, but and you talk a little bit about this. This is systems and how systems work, how the coral reef keeps itself healthy without interference, how the old growth forest works better than any kind of grove of red pine that people will plant. And I'm wondering, that fits well within the definition of biomimicry, doesn't it?
I think so, yes, on that ecosystem level. Looking at, I mean, that's what's, you know, really, like I said, as it unfolds as you go deeper and deeper and you start to look into an organism. In fact, and you look at the ecosystem lessons, and what you find is that the products that are being made in that system, you know, the ceramics that's being made,
yep,
works. The manufacturing process works. It doesn't hurt the abalone. It enhances, you know, at the end of its life, it goes back and it enhances the place rather than depleting the place. So the lessons about how those systems fit together to constantly enhance and increase fertility. You know, why does a prairie build soil beneath it? It literally builds soil while our agriculture washes it away. There's a lesson there, and that ecosystem lesson, that's one that's going to take us many, many years to actually turn our economy into something that, you know, it gives back and actually increases capacity here on Earth, increases fertility here on Earth. I think it's possible because I have, you know, I have existence proof for it outside the door. But I think it's going to take learning from ecologists about how these organisms are transferring resources to one another, spreading carbon around the forest as they do. Using in a prairie, using every inch of the root line. You know, there's some plants that are shallow rooted and then mid rooted and then deep rooted, and all of them use that habitat in a way that actually builds that soil up. We have to have an economy that works in the same way.
Well, I think you'll have us all looking a little bit differently at the park on our walk home today, Janine. I want to thank you for being with us.
You're welcome, Dick. Thanks for having me.
Janine Benyus is biologist at the Design Table and author of Biomimicry, Innovation Inspired by Nature. We also talked on the program with Julian Vincent, biologist and professor at the University of Bath Center for Biomimetics and Natural Technologies. More about biomimicry on our website at theconnection.org, and also a link to the Massive Change website. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.